So one thing to start us off with before we even begin is that Friday is the second anniversary of the Affordable Care Act, which from here on out I'm going to refer to as the ACA. And as you can see, just by your participation here, it's keeping both lawyers and law professors very, very busy. So it's dealing with our employment issues. And also, before we start out, I'd like to remind you that the ACA itself follows the current structure of health insurance in this country, which the rest of the world finds very weird. And that is, we actually offer, for most people, health insurance is provided through employers. And that sets up a lot of the problems, including the problems that we're going to be discussing today. And it's important to realize you might not have designed it that way, but that's actually what's going on here. Now, for many of you, I actually asked a number of my students, when did you first hear about this issue? And for most of them, it was around January, and that's when it suddenly became a live issue in the general public. But this issue was actually included in the original negotiations of the legislation. It was always intended to be part of it. And there have actually been fairly intense negotiations going on this specific issue since last summer. While state-mandated coverage for benefits is fairly common, it's actually only with the ACA that you have federally mandated coverage for specific benefits. And the ACA requires in section 2713 for the first time that private plans offer a wide range of clinical preventive services to plan holders without cost sharing. The idea is by eliminating cost sharing, you actually make it more likely that people will use the benefit. In 2010, shortly after the passage of the ACA, HHS requested that the Institute of Medicine actually study comprehensively gaps in preventive care for women. And these rules are written in that way. The focus is on women. Coverage of contraceptive services were among eight services identified by the Institute of Medicine, and HHS adopted those recommendations last summer. In regulations published last summer, HHS stated that all new insurance plans would be required to cover contraception as part of free preventive care mandated by the ACA. This rule will become effective in August 2012, with the exception of religious organizations that we'll be discussing today. The regulation exempts religious organizations. Those are defined as, one, has the inculcation of religious values as its purpose, two, primarily employs persons who share its religious tenets, three, primarily serves persons who share its religious, primarily serves persons who share its religious tenets, and four, is a nonprofit organization. This itself has some questions. There are questions whether that should include for-profit organizations and what it doesn't include. It generally exempts houses of worship, churches, synagogues, and the like from the requirement, but does not exempt religious-affiliated institutions such as universities and hospitals. And there are a great number of hospitals and universities which fall under this rule. The proposed regulations received more than 200,000 comments at the time, which is a lot. And so, as I said, this has been going on actually since the summer. The political flashpoint came in January when the Obama administration announced that it would allow religious-affiliated organizations, institutions, the universities and the hospitals, more time to comply with the regulation, but that they would not be exempt from the regulation. Shortly after that announcement, the administration offered a compromise that stipulates that insurers, rather than the religiously affiliated institutions themselves, would pay for the contraceptives and would be the point of contact for providing information about the benefit. Proponents of the compromise argue that since providing contraceptives saves healthcare expenses by avoiding the unintended pregnancies that might result from that means that this can be done without passing on any cost to the religiously affiliated institutions. Opponents of the compromise argue that it's an accounting gimmick. Proposed rulemaking detailing that plan was announced on Friday. There's a lot still going on within that proposed rulemaking and a lot of unanswered questions. The rub continues to be religious organizations that self-insure, and while the administration is floating ideas to deal with that, those rules are still in flux. To give this some background, most private plans, about 85% of large employers, cover prescription contraceptives in their plans. About 28 states, more than half, have mandated coverage of birth control. 20 of those have religious exemptions for religious employers. Some of those are very broad, some of those are very narrow. These states don't, if you've taken health law or ERISA, do not cover self-insured employer plans subject to ERISA. So this is actually a major move with the ACA in terms of federal coverage. Contraceptive coverage is also included in most government programs, and that has actually served as both a blueprint for some of the cost projections and some of the plans generally. There have been a number of lawsuits filed claiming that the regulations violate rights to free exercise of religion and freedom of speech under the First Amendment, the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, RFRA, and the Administrative Procedures Act. There has been an attempt to repeal the regulations, which failed recently in the Senate, but the issue is not going away, and there have been other proposed pieces of legislation coming up. So that sets the background, and now I'm going to turn it over to my colleagues to sort out the religious liberty and other issues as we work it through.
Part of what makes this difficult to talk about is that almost no one understands both the Affordable Care Act and the religious liberty stuff, right? So each of us understands half of this and dabbles a bit in the other half. The title of this program, I think, is misleading. It asks whether contraception is a basic necessity or a violation of religious liberty. And it seems to me obvious that the answer is that it's both. It is a basic necessity. I don't think anyone in this panel has any brief for the bishop's position on contraception. Like most Americans, I find it quite incomprehensible. But religious liberty is not limited to religious teachings we agree with. If it was, we wouldn't need to guarantee it. It would just take care of itself. It is also irrelevant how many Catholics agree with the bishops. American Catholics, some agree, most don't. And people have tried to make an issue of that. Each church is entitled to its own form of religious governance, and it's very clear in Catholicism that the bishops make the rules and the people don't get to vote. This is not, in the bishop's view, this dispute is not merely about contraception in the ordinary sense. The complaints have been filed, at least alleged, that the mandate includes the morning after pill and the 5-day after pill. I assume that's accurate.
Anything FDA approved.
Anything FDA approved. So for most of us, that's just another form of contraception. It's emergency contraception. The bishop's position, of course, is rather different, and while I don't agree with that position, it is certainly comprehensible. It's very logical and very straightforward. They believe that a new human being is created at the moment of fertilization and that any deliberate interference after that point is an abortion and actually is a homicide of that very young human being. The morning after and week after pill mostly act by preventing ovulation, which is the same way lots of other contraceptives act, but the FDA-approved labels say they also sometimes may act by preventing the implantation in the uterus of a fertilized egg, and it does not matter to the bishops how often that happens. If it happens or if it may happen, then these pills, in their view, are an abortifacient. So in their view, they're being asked to pay for things that are gravely sinful and that in some cases cause what they consider to be a form of homicide. Now, their view of the proposal that the insurance company be asked to provide this for free is, well, wait a minute. When the insurance company bids the contract, of course it's going to take account of the fact that after it gets the contract, it's going to have to provide this additional free benefit, and of course that's going to affect the price, and of course we are going to pay for it. Now, if it is really true that contraception saves money in the long run, and if the insurance company understands that, then maybe it doesn't raise the price that the insurance company has to pay this free benefit. I'm not sure the bishops have thought that part through all the way, but if they had thought it through, here's what they would say. Why did it turn out that regulation has to mandate the insurance coverage of preventing services in the first place? Well, it's because of the deep flaws in the way our health insurance market is structured. The insurance company has the contract this year, pays in the short term the cost of preventing services. They do not necessarily reap the benefit next year, the long-run payoff of those preventive services, because the contract may be reawarded to somebody else. And institutions shift their insurer fairly often, depending on who offers the best combination of benefits and low price at in any given year. So it may or may not work out that the price doesn't change, but the bishops certainly expect that the price will change. So they believe they're being asked to do something gravely sinful, and the administration believes they're being asked to provide a basic necessity for many American women. So what do we do with that? They're asking for an exemption, a religious exception from a generally applicable regulation. Religious exemptions have been part of the American experience of religious liberty since the 17th century. Quakers refused to swear oaths and refused to serve in the military. Sometimes they're created by courts interpreting the Constitution. More often they are created by legislatures, and there are lots of modern examples. No one thinks it's illegal to give communion wine to children. Well, it is, except for the fact that there's an implicit religious exemption operating. Native Americans in the Church of the Uniata Vegetal get to use hallucinogenics in their worship service. Catholics and Orthodox Jews and Muslims and some conservative Protestants get to refuse to ordain women. There are lots and lots of examples of religious exceptions that are not particularly controversial, and then there are some that become intensely controversial, and this obviously is the latter. So the these various Catholic institutions filed lawsuits under the Federal Free Exercise Clause and under the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, also under the Administrative Procedure Act, alleging defects in the rulemaking and failure to pay attention to the 200,000 comments, and I don't know anything about that claim. So let's talk about RFRA and free exercise. The RFRA claim is the strongest and the most obvious, although the two claims turn out not surprisingly to be closely related. The Religious Freedom Restoration Act says the federal government may not substantially burden a person's exercise of religion unless the imposition of that burden on that particular person is the least restrictive means to serve a compelling government interest. The persons of course, includes both individuals and institutions. I assume the government is going to say that its compelling interest is inadequate health care for women. The complaints have been filed. I haven't seen the answers yet. In general, the government cannot claim as compelling an interest that it does not pursue across the board. If it allows lots of exceptions to its pursuit of an interest, then courts tend to say, you, the government, have decided for yourself this isn't a compelling interest. This is a case where you can afford to allow exceptions, and therefore you can afford to allow one more for this religious organization. And exceptions are relevant to the compelling interest test. They're also relevant to the church's prima facie case under the Free Exercise Clause. The Religious Freedom Restoration Act applies to any federal law, including generally applicable and neutral federal laws. The Free Exercise Clause, as the Supreme Court has interpreted, does not require exceptions from neutral and generally applicable laws, but it does require exceptions if the law is not neutral or not generally applicable, and the number of exceptions also then goes to that question, whether the law is generally applicable or not. So now I have to tiptoe over on the other side of the issue into the Health Care Act a little bit. What does it look like in terms of exceptions? Well, for starters, there's an exception for employers with fewer than 50 employees, and that turns out to exempt 20 to 40 million American workers. It does not apply to grandfathered plans, of which there appear to be a great many, and they may continue to be grandfathered for many years. And the Department of Health and Human Services has granted administrative waivers. Allegedly, they have granted thousands of administrative waivers. The one that got a lot of press was that McDonald's got a waiver on the ground that it simply could not afford to provide full health coverage for its low-income workers who are flipping burgers and fish fillets. When the government is willing to make tens of millions of exceptions, it becomes very difficult to say that this interest is so compelling it cannot afford a religious exception for these religious institutions that need it. So the millions of exceptions go to the compelling interest test. They also go to whether the law is neutral and generally applicable. It has all those exceptions, it's not generally applicable, and it embodies an implicit value judgment that is not neutral. In effect, the administration has said McDonald's low-wage business model is more important than the Catholic bishop's belief that they're being asked to kill babies. McDonald's gets an exception. Catholic colleges and hospitals do not get an exception. The government would never say it that way. They would never spell it out that explicitly. But as Justice Alito said in an opinion on the Third Circuit, when the government grants an exception for one thing and doesn't grant an exception for some other thing that undermines the government interest to the same extent, it is making a value judgment about which claimed need for an exception is more important. Like many disputes, this is a matter of who is imposing on who and whether the religious minorities in the country can have some place where they can live their own values. Most American women and the government see this as Catholic employers imposing Catholic values on employees who may be Catholic or non-Catholic but who do not share the church's teaching on this particular issue. The bishops see it as employees and students. This also applies to student health plans at Catholic colleges, who come to the Catholic institution for an education or to do the work of the church and then seek to impose their values on the Catholic institution. This is obviously politically charged litigation. What the courts will do with it remains to be seen. But the Catholic institution's claim here is doctrinally quite strong. Don't underestimate the Religious Freedom Restoration Act. No one would have thought that this little group of what their neighbors would pejoratively call hippies in Santa Fe, New Mexico, would get the right to use an hallucinogenic drug in their worship service. But that happened under the Religious Freedom Restoration Act. It happened 8-0, and John Roberts wrote the opinion. So the Catholics may also win this issue under the Religious Freedom Restoration Act.
Okay. Can you hear me? I think you can probably hear me without the mic, but I want to step back from the doctrinal question under RFRA, about which I'm largely in agreement with Doug's views on, to ask a couple questions more generally about the debate that's happening. So the first question I want to ask is whether it's fair to grant an exemption in this context. That's a question that sounds not just in the law, but maybe more generally in political morality. The second question I want to ask is, do the proposed regulations violate the church's freedom of conscience or any other religious group's freedom of conscience? And that question has to do with the relationship between our money and our conscience, and I want to say something about that. So first, this issue has been framed largely as a contest between religious liberty and reproductive choice, but I think in some ways that framing gives an advantage to those on the religious liberty side. On one side is a claim about freedom of conscience. The churches don't want to be made complicit in activities that they believe are morally wrong. On the other side is a claim about public funding of contraception, about which no one thinks anyway under existing doctrine anyone has a constitutional right. Putting things that way, someone's rights to conscience, which sound in constitutional doctrine, are violated to pay for another person's contraception. And I think putting things that way makes it hard to avoid granting exemptions. Are there any other ways to frame this issue? I think there are. One other way to understand the current debate is as part of a larger culture war. I think that's partly why there are lots of people in this room, aside from the Chick-fil-A. It's also that, and the nitty-gritty about the ACA or under complicated doctrine and the Religious Freedom Act, there are very large questions looming in this debate. In that culture war, the Catholic Church and other religious groups are prominent actors. They participate in the political process at the state and federal level to achieve various policy goals, including, one, prohibitions on abortion, including for what many think are extreme cases. Two, the defunding of family planning organizations, ostensibly on the grounds that they provide abortions, at least in some cases, but I think defunding might be a more general ambition. And third, opposition of public funding generally for contraception, even for the poor and destitute. It's been more than a generation in this country since the church advocated prohibitions on contraception, but there was a time when that was church policy. Yet even if the church has softened its position on that issue, and this is true for other religious organizations, not just the Catholic Church, but I'll use the church for shorthand because it's the leading actor in the current debate. The general point is that the church and other religious organizations are engaged in a general campaign to restrict access to abortion and contraception. To focus on abortion for just a moment, when the church and other religious groups are successful in using the political process to restrict access, they don't generally recognize rights of conscience of, for example, women and doctors to violate those restrictions. So the church doesn't recognize the right of a doctor to say, complying with a mandatory counseling or disclosure policy infringes on my conscience. A doctor might think that what he's required to say by state law is false. The information that he's required to convey to a pregnant woman, in some cases, a doctor might think is just simply not true. And so a doctor might say, I have rights under the First Amendment not to be compelled to say these things which I believe are false. That is, I have a claim sounding in the First Amendment to protect my conscience, not to engage in action or speech, which I think is wrong. I think it's fair to say that that the church and other religious organizations don't recognize the right of conscience in those cases. You might extend that general claim to the right of women to say, for example, complying with prohibitions on emergency contraception in, for example, cases of rape and incest would violate my conscience, and so I think I should be exempt from those statutes. Again, we don't think that religious groups that are seeking these kinds of restrictions in the legislative process recognize exemptions in this way. So the general point is that when women's groups and other progressive organizations use the legislative process to increase access to contraception, including emergency contraception and abortion services, in those cases, the church wants to claim an exemption. But I think this creates an asymmetry. When the church wins in the legislative process, it doesn't recognize the need for exemptions that burden conscience, but when it loses, it wants a constitutional bailout. And framed in that way, the demand for exemptions begins to look unfair. If you compete in equal terms in the political process, then you don't get an exemption when you lose. If you want exemptions, then you ought to be willing to reciprocate when the other side demands them. And fairness requires that there are rights at stake, to recognizing there are rights at stake on both sides of the broader constitutional or cultural conflict. I mean, I think the background way of putting that point is it's a lot easier to take seriously your demand for an exemption from a general law when you respect the rights of others who are engaged in the same conflict on the other side. We tend to think of religious exemptions as a way of creating a neutral posture between the state one religion doesn't impose on another religion. When both sides have strong views, they grant each other exemptions and we create some reciprocity and a way of working through our disagreements in that way. But this isn't just a debate between one religious group and another religious group. It's a debate between some religious groups and people who have other types of claims, especially here rights to reproductive choice and to access contraception on the other side. And if we think that the logic of exemptions applies in this debate, we ought to think it applies, I think, on both sides. The second question I want to ask is about whether the proposed regulations violate conscience. And this question has to do with the relationship between our money and our conscience. That is, does funding something that we object to, morally speaking, implicate our freedom of conscience? And there's some law on this question, especially in the Establishment Clause context. Let me just give you some facts from a case that was decided last year by the Supreme Court called Arizona Christian School Tuition Organization against Wynn. In that case, the Supreme Court held that taxpayers lack standing to challenge a public tax credit used to fund scholarships for religious schools. The taxpayers in that case claimed that they had standing to bring an Establishment Clause claim because their tax dollars were used to promote religious schools, especially schools whose messages they disagreed with. They invoked the principle, this is apropos to UVA, right? Jefferson's principle, right? You can't have a presentation at UVA without an appeal to the founder. So
here's contraception.
Right. Yeah, I don't know what he had to say about contraception. Here's what he had to say about money in your conscience, right? Here he is from the Bill for Religious Freedom. He says that to compel a man to furnish contributions of money for propagations of opinions which he disbelieves and abhors is sinful and tyrannical. And you might think of the Catholic Church in this context as invoking something like Jefferson's principle. They don't want to pay for something that they think is morally wrong. Speech, action, whatever it is. So here's what happens in Wynn. With Justice Kennedy writing, the court basically affirms Jefferson's principle, at least with respect to the Establishment Clause. But it says under the facts of that case that none of the challengers' tax money would end up going to religious schools. Your money only goes to the religious school in that case if you choose to take advantage of the tax credit. That is, if you give a contribution, you get a credit back. But if you don't give a contribution, none of your money goes off to a religious school. And since your conscience follows your money, right, your conscience is not implicated by a tax credit scheme, and so you don't have a right of conscience sounding in the Establishment Clause. Here's what the acting Solicitor General defending this tax scheme said at oral argument. He begins the oral argument in this way, pitching an argument to Justice Kennedy, who is, of course, the swing vote on this issue. Wynn comes down with Kennedy writing. He says, if you placed an electronic tag to track and monitor each cent that respondents plaintiffs pay in tax, not a cent, not a fraction of a cent, would go into any religious school's coffers. And the argument here is, again, that your money tracks your conscience or vice versa. Your conscience follows your money. And if you can't show that your money showed up in the coffers of some institution that you disagree with, you don't have a claim. The question here in the contraception mandate is, will the proposed regulations make it such that the money from religious organizations won't actually see their way into funding contraception? The Department of Health and Human Services has created a proposal, set of regulations, where they claim that this is not the case. The Catholic Church comes back and says, it's a gimmick, it's a trick. Right? There's a Star Wars reference. It's a trap. I mean, they think it doesn't really matter. It's just an accounting trick, and a clever accounting trick. But of course, it's a clever accounting trick on the Establishment Clause side, too, where public funding of religious schools flows through various kinds of tax credit mechanisms in order to avoid this implication that your money is going someplace where it shouldn't be going. In the contraception debate, we're hearing similar arguments, and the positions here are reversed. Proponents of contraception coverage are saying, if you put a tracer on every dime of the church's money, none of it goes to contraception. They're also saying a lot of that money is public funding, but I'll leave that point aside from now. The church is saying it's a clever accounting trick, and when it comes to vouchers, though, the church seems okay with clever accounting. And of course, those who object to funding with respect to religious schools don't seem to mind when it comes to contraception. So the question of how our consciences are related to our money, I think, is fraught. Both sides seem to have conflicting positions depending on what's being funded, and both positions seem opportunistic to me. We don't have a good theoretical solution to that question, a principled way of resolving that connection, but I think thinking about that more theoretically is very important to getting to the bottom of this dispute. Thanks.
Hi. I'm going to avoid some of the religious liberty, all of it, topics, and come from a health law perspective, and just try to provide some context, background, to try to understand some of the influences on this debate. The first is, so basically I want to make three points. The first is that I think this latest controversy over employer payment for contraception has to be considered in light of the 20-plus years of the erosion, strategic and incremental, of women's reproductive rights. And that's one of the reasons why women are so upset about it. It's not an isolated incident. The erosion of reproductive rights can be seen in the courts, federal and state, and in legislation, federal and state. So in the Supreme Court, the fundamental right to abortion recognized in 1973 in Roe v. Wade has been weakened by the Supreme Court's 1992 decision in Planned Parenthood v. Casey, which established the weaker undue burden standard, and by the Supreme Court's 2007 decision in Gonzales v. Carhart, which upheld a federal statute banning certain abortion procedures without an exception for the pregnant woman's health. At the state level, our country has seen a plethora of laws, and even more that have been debated and introduced and narrowly did not pass, but still many have passed, that have required state-mandated information be provided to pregnant women prior to an abortion, which is some of, I think, what Micah was talking about with respect to doctors having to provide certain information, requiring ultrasounds of pregnant women prior to abortion, and that, of course, has gotten a lot of play recently in Virginia and elsewhere. And actually, I don't know if you know this, but Texas already had a law requiring, in certain instances, a transvaginal ultrasound. Requiring more onerous clinical standards that facilities must meet in order to provide abortion. We've had that in Virginia as well. Recognizing wrongful death actions for fetuses and punishing feticide, like homicide, in ways that bolster the view of the fetus as a person. And then outright statutes that declare that an embryo or a fetus or a product of human conception is a person with all personhood rights. So in 2010 and 2011, each year there were at least 430 abortion-related bills introduced into state legislatures. And last, some of it becomes absurd, and last night I read, you don't know whether it's just absurd or whether it just makes you angry, but last night I read about a bill introduced into the Georgia state legislature which would have suggested that miscarriages could be investigated. So while I think the constitutionality of any of these particular laws or the wisdom of them could be debated, I think what we can't miss is that considered in total, they amount to a severe reduction in women's reproductive rights and an assault, and I think this is particularly important, an assault on the moral agency of women, understanding women as being able to make these moral choices themselves. The second point I'd like to make is that while the moral agency of women in matters of reproduction have been slowly and steadily eroded, the ability of other private citizens to influence or affect women's reproductive rights has increased, and not just reproductive rights, as we'll see, but other healthcare decisions, and not just women. Because throughout this same time period, there's been a rise of protection for conscientious refusal or objection by various professionals and others to the performance of certain procedures or the provision of certain kinds of health care, disproportionately affecting women, but as I said, not only women. The first such laws were adopted after Roe v. Wade and generally protected physicians from any requirement to perform abortion, to provide abortion services. But there has been a recent and steady explosion of similar conscientious refusal claims to cover procedures or practices much further removed from abortion and to cover many more persons. You may have heard of pharmacists who have opposed providing Plan B or contraceptives, but there's no reason to stop there. Should housekeeping be protected from cleaning rooms in which abortions have taken place? Should receptionists be protected from passing along referral information provided by a physician to a patient? These are the kinds of claims that are now being made. And it's not just women's reproductive health that is the subject of conscientious objection. We see these claims elsewhere, and in particular at the other end of life, the other end of the spectrum. There are similar claims to protection for refusal to provide pain relief to people who are at the end of life, or to provide care for individuals who wish to refuse a feeding tube in certain institutions. The third point, so I think this whole debate has to be looked at in that context, right? The context of the erosion of reproductive rights generally, and the context of the increase in the number of people and the kinds of influences they can have on others' healthcare decisions. And then the final point I'd like to make is about the particularity of today's topic, which is at the intersection of private action and government action. The court said in Eisenstadt v. Baird, if the right of privacy means anything, it is the right of the individual, married or single, to be free from unwarranted government intrusion into matters so fundamentally affecting a person as the decision whether to bear or beget a child. The question today may not appear to be one of government intrusion, but of employer intrusion. But why, we should ask, are employers involved in our health care anyway, and should they be? The fact that many people get their insurance through their employers and that the ACA builds on this practice is really rooted in history, and some accidental history, I would say, rather than logic. Prior to World War II, few Americans had health insurance, and the policies were fairly meager. During World War II, there was a wage freeze imposed by the federal government, and so companies trying to compete for scarce workers started adding health insurance benefits. The unions also were in favor of this. So the health insurance replaced wages. Otherwise, wages would have gone up, but couldn't because of the wage freeze, which was a governmental action. And then this mechanism of compensation through health insurance was further bolstered by the fact that workers' health benefits were not subject to income tax or Social Security payroll taxes, as were cash wages. So this favorable tax treatment for many, many years has fostered a private insurance system in our country that is administered through employment. Under the current tax code, health insurance premiums paid by employers are deductible for employers as a business expense, but are also excluded without limit from workers' taxable income. So there's really no good reason for us to continue receiving insurance through our employment and thus have it dictated by employers, except that it is a system that we are familiar with. So one thing that would be really interesting about this whole debate is if we start to re-examine that. And if this comes out, I could see a good end to all of this if we started re-examining whether this is the kind of system that we want. I'm going to turn it back to Mimi.
So let me ask the question that tags directly into that, in a sense, but asks, of course, a bigger question as well. And essentially is, are we on a train wreck heading towards inevitable the court deciding this issue, political nightmares, or are there compromises and solutions that might be available? So first piece is, does the administration's compromise provide any real compromise that has a solution here? And then are we inevitably onto a road where essentially we're going to have a public option for contraception? Is that the only way to get through Professor Laycock's issues? And could that public option then be the first Lego in the building of a larger public option generally?
Well, you know, I think the essential political problem here is that both sides view these issues as utterly uncompromising. Right? And the bishops are totally inflexible and totally unreasonable from the point of view of anyone who disagrees with them. But so is NARAL and the pro-choice movement, right? So neither side is willing to compromise, which leaves the administration in a very difficult position and may leave this in court. You know, I entirely agree with what Micah said, but again, it's a two-edged sword, right? Both sides aggressively work to defend their own liberties and take away the liberties of the other side. And I've said that to Catholic audiences, right? You would be a lot more credible if you would recognize some right to liberty with the people you disagree with and not only insist on your own liberty. But that's the nature of the culture war that we find ourselves in. There are live and let live solutions here, in which the right to abortion and reproductive freedom is fully protected, the right to gay relationships and gay marriage is fully protected, and the right not to participate in those relationships and those medical procedures and not to facilitate them is also fully protected. Neither side is interested in live and let live, and so this is quite likely to wind up in the courts. If it became the first step to public option, That would be terrific in my view. Protecting religious liberty should not be a left-right issue. I protect religious liberty because I'm a libertarian, and or a civil libertarian, not an economic libertarian, but a civil libertarian. And you shouldn't have to agree with the people seeking to live their own values in order to recognize their right to live their own values. I think it's true on the religious side, and I think it's true on the secular side, and neither side is willing to concede that to the other.
Did you want to?
Yep.
I agree.
Yeah, so I agree, too. I mean, I think that's right, so we have a panel agreement. Great. Table win, right? But I would say this: the point about employer mandates is important. The other part that's important is that Catholic hospitals and religious institutions generally account for a huge percentage of health provision in this country. Something like a sixth of healthcare patients, healthcare services are provided by religious institutions in this country. So to the extent that public services are attached to particular religious views, this is going to be a persistent problem given the way that we structure healthcare funding and healthcare service providing. So absent not just the healthcare, some type of public option on the healthcare insurance side, but also publicly available healthcare services, we're going to continue to run into these difficulties where groups are seeking exemptions and other groups are seeking services that aren't tied to particular religious directives. I think that's an endemic problem given the way that we've set up the system. It's a recipe for continued conflict.
I think that's right. The issue today might be about this employer mandate, but we do have a lot of religious healthcare institutions. Of course, those aren't by accident either. I mean, those have been fostered by government, and so we can make choices if we've decided we're kind of all in this together on the health insurance, and that we have obligations to one another in terms of access to healthcare. Then maybe we have to rethink all of that. Because it's one thing I'm worried about right now at the end of life with respect to the Pope in 2005 changed longstanding church position on feeding tubes and said basically that they were mandatory. And one of the things that I'm working on right now is some research to determine what did that actually then make a difference in nursing homes and hospitals that are associated with Catholic healthcare, and we'll just see. If they're ignored, that's one problem. If they're followed, that's a different problem. But maybe we need to just get religious institutions out of healthcare. Not force them out, but not, we've helped create this system.